Genesis chapter 12. It feels like only yesterday. But do you realize that in a little bit over two months, it will be 40 years since man stepped on the moon? 40 years. July 20th, 1969. And that feels like yesterday. It just doesn't seem like it was very long ago. But there was an extremely important thing that happened once they landed on the moon. They needed to plant the flag. What is going on when they plant the flag? They're saying, we're here. Now, they weren't claiming the moon for the United States. It isn't going to be the 51st state. It won't meet the qualifications of population. It would also be kind of expensive to build a Capitol building and all those kinds of things. The long-distance phone calls would be pretty expensive. But it was necessary to say we arrived. Because you remember, at the beginning of that decade, Sputnik had gone up. And President Kennedy announced that before the decade was out, for the United States to put a man on the moon. And it looked for a long time that we were going to be number two. But the United States was the first one to put its flag on the moon. When you put a flag, you are claiming it. You are saying, this is something that our country has accomplished. Now, there's going to be something very pertinent to this as we start to figure out what the passage as a whole that we're looking at tonight is teaching. Now, you might wonder, why are we starting in Genesis chapter 11 with verse 27? Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked it. It's very observant. You'll notice that I have put the word toledot for the flow of preceding chapters. That's the Hebrew word that is translated generations in the statement that appears many times in Genesis. These are the generations of. If you were to look in the Old King James, they translate it literally that way. The New King James has paraphrased it. But what we could say is the meaning of it is this, that is the following section, is what became of the lineage of so-and-so. Moses has used these toledot statements, these are the generations of, to introduce what became of the lineage of the person who's mentioned in that statement. That's the basic outlining division here within the book of Genesis. We saw that the first section does not have a toledot, but it starts out with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. Days 1 through 3, God filled the earth, or he formed it, and then days 4 through 6, he filled it, and the seventh day he rested, not because he was tired, but because his work was done. Then we have a toledot statement in 2:4. And it's what became of creation? What became of those people that were created, the man and the woman? And we come down to the point where Cain murders Abel. So Abel did not have a lineage, but he was killed before that happened. Doesn't look like this is what became of. It was ending on a very positive note. Well, then we have the third toledot, and it looks at all of Adam's descendants died except Enoch, who walked with God. Then it talks about the demon infiltration into planet Earth, but Noah found grace in God's eyes. The fourth toledot starts at 6:9. God used the universal flood to judge humanity. And then, as a final note on that, Noah had three sons, and through those three sons, the lineage of humanity was continued, despite a flood that was designed to wipe out almost the entire human population. Then in Genesis chapter 10, 1 through 11, 6, we have what became of those three sons. And then we hit a very strategic point at 11:27, where there is going to be a focus now on one of those lineages as it culminates in a man named Terah. But now notice the sixth Toledot, Genesis 11:27 through 25:11. That's a very long section, isn't it? That's about a fourth of the book. About a fourth of the book is devoted to what became of Terah. And what became of Terah is Abraham. And so the focus on Abraham's life is looking at what became of that lineage as we look at Terah, who was a descendant of Shem, who was one of those that was rescued in the ark for the deliverance from the flood. There are only a few more Toledot sections here within the rest of the book. What we're going to be doing in this series is we're going to work on this Toledot. We're going to go through the life of Abraham. Once we finish that, we'll take a break and we'll be in some other books for a while, and then we'll come back. Well, let's now take a look at New Exposition, starting in Genesis 11:27 through 32. In that, we are told, this is the genealogy of Terah, or more literally, these are the generations of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot. Haran died before his father, Terah, in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. Then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren. She had no child. Now, as we look at this section, it's looking at what became of Terah, and what we can say is Abram. But we're given a little more background. We need to know just a little bit more in order that when we start studying Abram, we have a little bit more information about him. So for verses 27 and 28, Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran, who died in Ur, begot Lot. Now we have here a map that is showing basically the Fertile Crescent. Ur is down here in the upper one. Okay, that helps to remember the instructions I was given last week. Okay, Ur is down here, and then we see mention about Haran, and later on there will be mention about the land of Israel called Canaan here. Now, as we look at this section, it's going to be important just to note that although Abram is the first one mentioned, he was not the eldest son. And we might think, first one mentioned, he was mentioned because he was the eldest. Not so. Look at the numbers that we have down there at the bottom of the first page. Abram was not the eldest, even though he's listed first. Now, if we look at 11:32, we note that Terah died at age 205 in Haran. Verse 32, so the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Well, then if we look back at 11:26, he had the first of his three sons at age 70. Genesis 11:26. Now, Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Well, if you subtract 70 from 205, you come up with 135. So we can say that Terah died 135 years after his first son was born. But now if we look down at verse 4 of chapter 12, So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. There is no way that Abram is the eldest son. The eldest son in the family is about 60 years older than Abram. What we have is that Abram is listed first because of his importance in the argument of the book of Genesis. He's the one that Moses is going to concentrate on. So he's listed first, but he is not the eldest. Notice also this verse explains Lot's presence in the book. Abram was guardian to Lot in his younger years. And that is because Haran, his father, died while they were still in Ur, before they traveled out of the land. Now, I've always thought in my family that we had a pretty good-sized generation gap, because my older brother, I only have one brother, he's 16 years older than me, and there's no one in between us. Can you imagine having a family where there's 60 years between the eldest and the youngest of the three sons? My folks always talked about how they raised two separate families. This family must have had an interesting household. Can you imagine having kids that far apart? That must have been something else. Now, we've established that Abram is not the eldest. He's probably the youngest. In verses 29 through 30... Abram married Sarai, who is his half-sister, who was barren. And Nahor married Milcah. In verse 29, it reads, "Then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, the name of Nahor's wife Milcah, and the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren, she had no child." Now, this passage helps us to understand in Genesis chapters 12 and 20 where Abram told Sarah to say that she was his sister. She actually is his half-sister. So what we have set up in these verses is the reason that Lot is present, and we also have an explanation for why it is that Abram would have Sarah say that she was his sister. Couple of words here. The word Sarah, to which her name is later changed, means princess. Now, a lot of preachers like to wax eloquent on what they think that her name means because they think she was named in Hebrew. We have no way of knowing whether she was named in Hebrew or whether it was another language. So what people like to say is, well, Sarai means contentious. We have no idea what her name actually meant. I can't imagine any parent saying, "Wow, got to name my daughter contentious." I don't think she was named in Hebrew. Well, then this brings us up to verses 31 and 32, where Terah's clan, Abram, Lot, and Sarai went from Ur to Haran and dwelt there where Terah died on their way to Canaan. Verses 31 and 32. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai and his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now, it's important for us to make note of a passage just to have a bit of an idea of what this family believed. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 31, verse 53. We are told in various passages that the family started out in idolatry, but by the time of Terah's death, Terah was a worshiper of the Lord. Genesis 31:53. This is where Laban and Jacob are dealing with one another, and they're needing to have an oath, and so they are making the oath here. The God of Abram, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father. Who's their father? Terah. Judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. This passage is giving indication that Abram, Nahor, and Terah all had the same God. So by the end of his life, we can say that he had become a worshiper of the Lord. Now, something very interesting. We all know about Abram, and we're told how Abram led his family from Ur up to Haran, and then led his family down to Canaan. Who does it say in this passage was doing the leading? Verse 31, and Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, and they went. Who's leading? Terah. This should raise a few questions, but we'll come up with a few answers. Those answers, though, are going to require looking at the chronology more carefully than I believe it's normally looked at. So let's go into God's promise. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. In verse 1, the Lord commanded Abram, and I would say that this is after Terah had died. That's an uncommon view. The Lord commanded Abram after Terah died to leave his country and family, namely, he was to leave his father's household. Now, many sermons have been preached that would say that chapter 12, verses 1 and following, happened prior to chapter 11, verses 31 to 32. In other words, it's normally taught that what is going on here is, if you look at chapter 11, verses 27 through 30, that happened. And then God made the promise, chapter 12, and then the family left Ur. However, grammatically, that is not what the passage sets up. In Hebrew, there is a structure that is regularly used to say, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And despite the way that chapter 12, verse 1 is translated, starting out with the word now, the grammar is a preterite with a vav consecutive. And another way, the proper way of rendering this, and then the Lord said to Abram, chapter 12, verse 1. We'll get into the reason that most translations have favored switching this around and ignoring the grammar. You're trying to solve another problem. I don't think that that problem really needs to be worried about. This text right here, it should read, then the Lord said. Now, why is this important? Take a look at chapter 12, verse 24. So Abram departed sort of like the Lord said. No, it doesn't say that, does it? So Abram, in chapter 12, verse 4, departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. What we are being told in chapter 12, verse 4, is that Abram obeyed. How many sermons have we all heard that say, well, Abram left Ur, and he didn't leave behind his father, and he didn't leave behind Lot, And then when we looked at chapter 11, verse 31, who was leading? Was it Abram or was it Terah? It was Terah. And yet, Moses writes a commentary on what Abram did, and he says he departed as the Lord had spoken to him. He didn't say he partially obeyed. He's saying he obeyed. God said, leave your country, your family, that is your father's household, and your father's house. Now, when God actually said this is going to be important. If you notice in the handout, if God said it while they were in Ur, then according to 11:31, Terah is the leader, isn't he? And furthermore, he wouldn't have taken his father's family, that is, he wouldn't take his father, Terah. On the other hand, if the chronology is established by 12:1 having a then we would have this passage appearing after Terah has died. Well, who is the leader in going down to the land of Canaan? Who is the leader on this portion of the trip? It is Abram. Terah has died up here. God makes the revelation telling Abram to go. Abram goes. He leaves his father's household. His father is already dead. Abram is leading. There's not a problem here. Abram is obeying. So the big question here is, does chapter 12, verse 1 occur in Ur, or does it occur in Haran? I would argue, according to the grammar that is here, that the call happened in Haran. Now, there's a simple reason why translations have avoided taking this solution. And that is Stephen's sermon in the book of Acts. So let's turn to Acts chapter 7, verse 1. Here, as Stephen was ready to be stoned, he gave a summary of Israel's history. And all the people that were listening to him were saying, yeah, this happened, and then this happened, yeah. And they didn't see any problem with what he was saying. Then finally, as he gets near the end of the message, he makes it very pointed, and he says, we've been looking at Israel's failure to obey God, and that's what you're doing right now. So he took them through a history of how Israel had failed. Now look at chapter 7, verse 2, as Stephen is speaking. Brethren and fathers, listen. The glory of God appeared to our father Abram when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Haran, and said to him, get out of your country and from your relatives and come to a land that I will show you. Then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran, and from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell. Well, that raises an issue of a contradiction between what Moses says and what Stephen says. A lot of people think that that would affect inerrancy. It does not. Luke accurately recorded what Stephen said. Stephen, I believe, made a minor error in terms of his grammar, in terms of his understanding of what Genesis said. But Luke has accurately recorded it, so it does not create a problem for inerrancy. Is it clear why that doesn't create a problem for inerrancy? Let me give another illustration. Does the Bible ever record Satan lying? Okay, well, does that create a problem for inerrancy? No. because it is an accurate recording of what was said. Stephen is not guaranteed to be inerrant. Luke is. Luke accurately records what was said. Any further questions? Any questions you would like to ask on this particular point? Okay, what I would say is, Genesis ought to be what interprets Genesis. We shouldn't ignore the grammar that Moses has given to us, saying that chapter 12, verse 1, happened after the conclusion of chapter 11, rather than before it. Genesis and its grammar tells us that the call of Abram occurred in Haran, not in Ur. With that, Abram is obedient. Now, with that, let's back up and let's look a little more closely at 11:31. This is before the call. Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. What Moses has told us is the ultimate destination, the planned destination, was to go from Ur down into Canaan. Because this is desert, going along the rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, is a much more natural route. It's the normal trade route that was used. But as they went up there, Terah died. After Terah's death, God revealed to Abram that he was to go on, and God was going to give him a land. And he was going to fulfill other promises to him. Well, let's see what we have in verse 2 and examine the passage here. In verse 2, the Lord promised unconditionally to make Abram into a great nation, to bless him and to exalt Abram's name. In light of this blessing from God, Abram was supposed to be a blessing to others. Verse 2. See, actually, I did not read verse 1 there in terms of my exposition, so let's also read it. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you." So he's saying, leave your father's house, leave your father's family behind. Taking along Lot was not a problem. Because remember, in the background, Lot had for all intents and purposes become an adopted son to Abram because he cared for Lot after the death of Lot's father. So for all intents and purposes, he's more his family than his father's family. And so Abram is told, depart from here, leave your father's house and his household behind. And God promises in verse 2, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. Now, couple of interesting things here. This is what is called a covenant of grant. There are no strings attached. God says, I'm going to do these things. There are no conditions for perpetuating this covenant. Now note the sequence. Abram is to leave. Once he leaves, God blesses Abram and makes him into a great nation. Then the possession of this blessing is to evoke a response. Abram is to become a blessing. However, notice The phrase is translated as though it were just a simple future at the end of verse 2. You shall be a blessing. It actually is be a blessing. It is an imperative. He's being commanded to be a blessing. Now, I would recommend that you render it, be a blessing. Now, we say that this is unconditional, but we look at it and it says be a blessing. It talks about leaving, doesn't it? And a lot of people want to see conditions in this. However, God does not say to Abram, bless other people, and if you do that, I'll bless you. What does God say? I'm going to bless you. So, since I'm going to bless you, you bless others. Is the blessing by Abraham or Abram being made into a condition for him to be blessed? No. God says, I'm going to bless you. Since I'm going to bless you, bless others. That's going to be very important. Abram has already left. Does he need to keep traveling in order to receive the blessing? No. Does Israel need to travel in order to get the blessing? If Israel decides that they're not going to bless other nations, do they stop coming under this? Is it required that they bless others in order for them to be under this? No. This is an unconditional covenant. And actually, the rest of the Bible is arranged to show us how God is going to fulfill this. All of history is revolving around God's promise to Israel, and it is not dependent upon how Abram or how Abram's descendants behave as to whether or not they are under this covenant. It will not be revoked under any circumstance. So, let's now look a little more closely at the promise. I will make you a great nation. That's going to involve progeny, isn't it? And how old is Abram? 75. And his wife is 65. Genesis chapter 17, verse 17 tells us that Abram is 10 years older than Sarah. So if he's 75, she's 65. That's not the age that we're expecting them to have a whole passel of kids, is it? No. God will also make his name great. He's going to become powerful. He's going to become rich. And he's going to have a huge family. And he's going to be a great nation. All of those things look a little less than likely at Abram's age, don't they? So Abram said, no, I'm staying here. This is where I want to be. Right? No, Abram left. He went from Haran down to the land which the Lord showed him. Now notice, passage doesn't tell us here that Abram believed, does it? But would he have gone all the way down there if he didn't believe God? He took God seriously, and because God said, you go, and I'm going to bless you, he went. He believed God at this point. It's going to be very important, because we are going to argue that Abram became a believer at this point. And actually, Paul makes commentary on that, but we'll talk about that in a moment as we get into verse 3. Verse 3, the Lord will bless those who bless Abram and curse the one who curses him. In Abram, blessing will be extended to all families of the earth. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. How others treat Abram will determine whether God curses or blesses them. All nations in their foreign policy need to keep this in mind. The United States has been a beneficiary of this provision because the United States has always stood by Israel and its right to exist. Doesn't mean every decision that the nation of Israel makes is a good decision. Doesn't mean that we have to agree with them on every issue of foreign policy. But those nations that say Israel should be pushed into the ocean doesn't take long, and God starts dealing with them in adverse ways. There's always a temptation to abandon Israel. And the United States should bear in mind this particular issue that God raises. He promises to bless those who bless Abram and to curse those that curse him. That also is something that has a personal level as well. We should be a blessing to Jewish people, not a cursing. Now he says that he's going to bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Notice how the word bless comes up three times in this passage. But is it given a definition? What does blessing mean? There is not a narrow definition given here as to exactly what it talks about. However, Genesis, within the argument of Genesis, we can see that it includes everlasting life. Let's look at a couple of passages. Genesis 17:8. This is God making promise, more specific, to Abram. Also, I give to you and to your seed after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. God is saying that the land of Israel that receives its boundaries are defined in chapter 15, is given to Abram and to Abram's seed. Now, if Abram were in a tomb, rotting, never to rise again, and did not possess everlasting life, wouldn't that be a hollow promise? It would be like me saying, and my accountant, who's sitting over there, wouldn't let me make this as a serious proposal. If I said, if you die, I'll give you $1 million the day after you die. And you say, I could use it a little bit before that. It doesn't do me any good after. In the same way, what good does it do for Abram to have an everlasting possession if he is an everlasting? I mean, notice, we have an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. Do you remember Jesus' commentary on this passage or on related passages? In Matthew chapter 22, Jesus is talking to the Sadducees, and he says that God is the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. He is not a God of the dead, but a God of the living. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob possessed everlasting life way back in Old Testament times, and they still possess it today. That's the only way that an everlasting covenant does them any good. And this land is being given to you and to your seed, not just to your seed. And the other passages that are listed do the same things. Now notice, the blessing will also include the material prosperity in the kingdom. But at a minimum, everlasting life needs to be understood as part of what this is aiming at. Look at Paul's commentary in Galatians chapter 3, verse 8, which we considered back in our Galatians series. Galatians chapter 3, verse 8. And the Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel to Abram beforehand, saying, in you all the nations shall be blessed. Notice Paul's commentary, that it was looking towards the justification, the granting of everlasting life, the whole issue with regard to people receiving everlasting life, not just Abram's descendants, but Gentiles as well, the nations. And the term that's translated nations is regularly rendered Gentiles. Both Old and New Testaments have this usage. Notice, he sees it as the gospel preached beforehand to Abraham. So, as we look at Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, God has a program of blessing Gentiles who bless Abram, cursing Gentiles who curse him, and extending blessing through Abraham to all families of the earth, that is, to everyone. And the blessing includes everlasting life. Doesn't mean that everyone has everlasting life, but the provision, the possibility of people receiving everlasting life is extended throughout. So what is Abram's response to these promises that God made? Abram goes to Canaan and he worships. In chapter 12, verse 4, Abram obediently left Haran at age 75, taking Lot. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Now the passage, as we've noted before, does not mention Abram believing. But Abram wouldn't have done this if he didn't believe what God had promised. God promised, he said, go, and I'll do these things. So what did Abram do? He went. The reason he went, he believed the Lord. This is despite his advanced age, the advanced age of his wife. None of these things look like they make sense on the human level. But Abram believed the Lord. Now, I think that Genesis chapter 15, verse 6 reinforces this interpretation. Okay, you might wonder about that TV set. I believe that Genesis 15, 6 is going to reinforce what has been said here. Abram had already believed in the Lord way back in Haran. Now, the reason that I have this particular screen up here is that we need to understand something about the chronology of Genesis 15. Notice how it reads in Genesis 15, 1. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying. Now, that word saying is a normal feature because neither Greek nor Hebrew had quotation marks. Have you ever wondered when you're reading through the Gospels and it said, so-and-so asked, saying, and you say, why does it have two verbs for speaking? Have you ever noticed that showing up in the Bible a lot? When you have that second one showing up, it's a way of saying, quote, here's the section that's going to be stated. Where does the vision start? Right after the word saying. But I'm going to tell you that most interpreters do not understand the vision to have started there. And the reason for that is they say, when you have a vision, you go to sleep. And we look down further in the passage in verse 12. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep came upon Abram. And that's where a lot of people want to start the vision. But where does it say the vision starts? Right here, in 15:1. Why is that important? Abram's looking at this TV set. Abram's looking at a vision. So at first he sees himself standing up and talking with God. And after a while, he's looking, and lo and behold, he goes and he lays down. He goes to sleep. He sees a vision of himself going to sleep. Doesn't mean that the vision starts in verse 12. It means that during the vision, Abram's seeing himself going to sleep. Okay, that makes sense? So it isn't that the vision starts in chapter 15:12. It starts in 15:1. But during the vision, it gets to be nighttime, and Abram sees himself going to sleep. So there he is looking himself going to sleep. Okay, so he's watching a TV set, per se, for the illustration. Now, that's going to make it important for us to understand the chronology of the first seven verses. See, actually on this overhead, the last one should say seven instead of six. Hebrew uses vav consecutives and preterites to say this happened, then this, then this, then this, then this. And if they want to say that something happens in a different sequence, then they use a different structure. And verse 6 has a different structure. So as we look at this, 15:1, after these things. So that's after chapter 14, isn't it? So that's another way of saying next. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram. In verse 2, then Abram said. So first we have the vision starting, and as the vision starts, the Lord says, don't be afraid. Then Abram answered. Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me? Then, verse 3, Abram said, and verse 4, then, behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, verse 5, then he brought him outside. But verse 6, now he had believed in the Lord. It doesn't say that verse 6 is next. It says this is a meanwhile back at the ranch. But verse 7 goes on with, then he said to him. Why is this important? Imagine this. Here we have a vision. So Abram's looking at that TV set. Oops, wrong way. Abram looks at his TV set. Word of the Lord came saying, don't be afraid. And then Abram sees himself saying, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I have no child? Then Abram said, look, you've given me no offspring. Then Abram sees the word of the Lord coming to him saying, this one shall not be your heir. Then he sees the Lord bringing him outside and saying, look now toward heaven and count the stars. And then in verse 6, Abram had already believed. This happened in the past. Just think with me for a moment. Isn't this an impressive passage if Abram saw himself in the vision believing? Anyone have a problem with that? Does that really make a convincing thing? Wow, Abram saw himself believing. What we have instead is a meanwhile back at the ranch. Abram had already believed. That's not part of the vision. That's what's being said when it's saying, now he had. Moses is telling us, this man to whom God is revealing himself had already believed. Remember we argued in Genesis 12:1 that the Lord made the promises while Abram was in Haran. So Abram fully obeyed God's command as verse 4 affirms. He did not partially obey. Abram was already a believer back in Haran. I'd like for you to look at another commentary on this passage. Let's go to Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 11. Yes. 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 It's not within the vision itself. It's background to the vision. A very good treatment of this appears in Creation and Blessing by Ellen Ross. So a very good treatment of this issue. Hebrews chapter 11. Verse 8. By faith, Abram obeyed when he was called to go out to the place he would receive his inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. Is it likely that the Word of God is going to make a big point about the faith of an unbeliever? By faith, Abram, who was already a believer, he already believed in the Lord, went out as God commanded. So I would argue that it is back in chapter 12, before Abram goes, that he has already believed what the Lord has promised. He already has believed the Lord's promise. And we're told in a commentary by Hebrews, something that we can figure out from Genesis all by itself. Why was it that Abram was willing to sacrifice his son Isaac? He believed God's promise and believed that God would even raise Isaac from the dead to make it so that he could fulfill the promise through Isaac. We see evidence from the text of Genesis that Abram believed the Lord early. Okay, back to Genesis chapter 12. Let's look at verse 5. Abram took Sarai and Lot and their possessions and the people they acquired in Haran to the land of Canaan. In 12:5 it says, then Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his brother's son and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan, so they came to the land of Canaan. I think most of the passage is self-evident, except who are all these people that they acquired? They can't be his progeny because he hasn't had any kids yet, right? Most people would argue that they were their slaves, and I don't think so. We're going to see some interesting evidence a little bit further in the passage. Theoretically, it could be a reference to servants or slaves, or it could be a reference to people voluntarily associating with this man whom the Lord was blessing. Let's think about it. God told Abram that he was going to bless him, didn't he? And he was also told that there were going to be people who would want to curse him. Abram is seeing his wealth increase and increase and increase, and there are people that are jealous that are around there. And there are others that are saying, we'd like to associate with this man. They wanted to bless him, and guess what? They were getting blessed as they were blessing Abram. I'm going to argue that the context is going to show us that it is people who are voluntarily associating with Abram. Very, very interesting how this passage is going to develop from this point. Verses 6 through 9. Abram publicly claims all of Israel for the Lord. Now in verse 6, it tells us that Abram went as far as Shechem to the terebinth tree of Moreh, surrounded by Canaanites. Verse 6. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh, and the Canaanites were then in the land. Here we have Shechem on the map being marked. Abram goes down that far. Now, terebinth tree is also known as a turpentine tree. And so guess where they make turpentine? And here is Shechem with Mount Gerizim behind it. When we look at John chapter 4, the Samaritan woman is at Sychar. She's in the vicinity of Shechem. Remember how she was talking about, you Judeans say that you should worship in Jerusalem, but we say you ought to worship on this mountain? That's what she's talking about. Here we have Shechem between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And passage that Ricardo worked through a few months ago talks about an event that happened there at Gerizim and Ebal. Now, it mentions in this passage a group that would want to curse Abram, Canaanites. Because Abram is being blessed as he shows up in the land that they are squatting on. And there he is being blessed and being blessed and being blessed. We're being reminded that there were those that would want to curse Abram. He would be seen as a threat as the Lord is increasing his wealth. Well, let's go on and let's look at verse 7. The Lord appeared to Abram at Shechem and told him that he gives this land to Abram's seed. Abram built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. So, in verse 7, then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. Notice, God says, I'm going to give this land to your descendants. To you and your descendants is implicit because of what we're told elsewhere. The promise is not just to the descendants, it includes Abram himself. But notice, again, no strings attached. And it's like when we look at this piece of real estate right here. We're looking at Maryland along the Tacoma River, the Potomac River, and looking at Virginia. And in the year 1789, Maryland, with no strings attached, gave a chunk of real estate away. Just gave it away. And a year later, Virginia did the same thing. Just free and clear. They gave it away. Have you ever heard of a state doing that? The area of Washington, D.C., because the capital was not supposed to be in any state. And so Maryland and Virginia ceded land so that the capital could be built, so that the District of Columbia could come into existence. No strings attached. Maryland can't come along and say at some point, you know, we really don't like the administration that's going on there. We'll take that land back. They gave it away. They gave it away permanently. And what does God say here? I give this land. The title deed is yours and your descendants. Now, the times when they'll be able to enjoy it are going to be when they're obeying the Lord. But they still have the title deed, whether in obedience or whether in disobedience. Something very important. Notice the last part of verse 7. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. Abram is worshiping the Lord. And where does he do it? He does it in a public location. He builds an altar. He gives testimony to the Lord who is blessing him. Remember it said back in the earlier part of the passage in verse 2, I will bless you. Abram is responsible to say to people, oh, this blessing isn't coming from me. This blessing is coming from the Lord that I worship. And Abram, in turn, is supposed to bless others. Now, if Abram has his lips zipped shut and doesn't tell people about the Lord, is he really blessing them? He has to tell them, it's this Lord whom I serve that is blessing me, and he wants to bless you too. And that blessing includes the concept of everlasting life and resurrection. God wants to do that. Why wouldn't he? Remember when that first Toledot section of Genesis, what happened? God created the heavens and the earth. He made them absolutely perfect. And what happened in the second Toledot? Sin and death entered the world. And everything God does is designed to bring about life and blessing to planet Earth. So what does he do? He puts Abram there to tell others about the God who blesses, including who blesses with everlasting life. And Abram is supposed to say, this blessing that I have is coming from the Lord whom I serve, and what you're seeing is only the tip of the iceberg. So Abram puts up an altar. He's worshiping the Lord publicly. It's like putting that flagpole there on the moon and saying, this land belongs to the Lord, so that he can tell people about the Lord whom he serves. Well, then what happens after that? Verse 8, the Lord sent Abram somewhere else. So he goes a little further south to a mountain between Bethel and Ai. And he built another altar to the Lord and worshipped him. Verse 8, and he moved from there to a mountain east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. He's calling on the name of the Lord. He is publicly proclaiming the Lord as he is worshiping him. He's calling people's attention to this Lord who's blessing him and who wants to bless others, but who will curse those that curse Abram. Now, where is it that he is? He is at Jebel et Tawil, which is east of El Bira, which is also known as Bethel. Let's look at this on a map. That mountain that we showed the picture of is the mountain that it mentions that between Bethel, the circle here on the upper left is Bethel, and there's Ai, and here is this ridge. And he puts up an altar there and publicly proclaims the Lord. What is Abram supposed to do? He is supposed to be broadcasting to people about the Lord who's blessing him, and the Lord who wants to bless other people. And that blessing extends even to everlasting life and the promises that God is going to fulfill for all of eternity. Well, then, Abram continues to make proclamation, and he goes down to the Negev. It's translated in your New King James as the south, but it's the Negev. So Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south, and we can understand him as making more altars, continuing to worship the Lord, continuing to tell people about the Lord, and giving them reason to believe in the Lord. Planting the flag, that's essentially what Abram's doing. He's urging people to worship the Lord. Just as the flag is planted to say, this belongs to the United States, Abram is saying, this land belongs to the Lord. He has a program. His program is one of blessing, you need to find out about the Lord. Any questions? Yes.
You had mentioned earlier the fact that Abraham was 75 when and Sarah was 65 and the probability of having kids. But just before that, you had emphasized the fact that in verse chapter 11, his father was 70 when he had his first kid. So I'm just thinking maybe the emphasis should be the fact that they didn't have any kids or she was barren, as opposed to that he was of such an age that he could not.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's not as much of an issue for men as it is for women. And we're not told how old Terah's wife was. So therefore, you know, there are some unknowns there. We're not, since his wife's name isn't mentioned, he might have had more than one. One might have died, might have had another. Yeah, there are a bunch of things we don't know. And Abram was having no difficulty fathering Ishmael. But then when it came to the time of Isaac, the text tells us he needed some help then. So, yes?
Yeah, chapter 15, verse 6. Does that begin with a Bob disjunctive?
Bob disjunctive on a perfect.
Bob disjunctive on a perfect. So it should scream out.
Yes. Yeah, it's not next in sequence. Ross has written on this in about three or four places. So it's an important issue that's often been overlooked. By the way, let me tie one detail together that I forgot to tie together. I said that I would, but when you look at verse 5 of chapter 12, the people whom they acquired in Haran, remember I said it wasn't his progeny, and I said most people think it was his slaves. I think it was people that were attracted to the Lord as they saw the Lord blessing him. And that's why I argued that it was people that were being won over by Abram. I see Abram there with a message about the Lord, and people are being attracted to it. Yes?
So in regard to that message, Abram is walking into a land which is Canaan, which, of course, by that time had not been as rank, so to speak, as it was when Joshua went in there. So when the scripture says the cup of the Amorites was not yet full, in a sense, there was not as much heinous sin at that point, so I would imagine that Abram really, in God's grace, was going in there. God's the cup was not yet full of the Amorites, so in a way, it was sort of like a...
Genesis 19 shows us it was bad enough.
But still, God was very gracious in allowing them that opportunity.
Yeah, yes, right. I don't think the issue is the amount of sinfulness. I think the issue of their iniquity is not yet full is that the timeline for their iniquity had not yet come to an end. I don't think that it's saying that they weren't as bad as they became. I don't think that's the emphasis. But yes, God is gracious, and God has given provision. And we see later on how Rahab believed that God was truly giving this land to Israel, and it affected her as a Canaanite. And you know, we see a lot of interesting things through the text. Yes?
And on the other hand, chapter 12, verse 1, that is not a Bob disjunctive, and yet the indication is given that it is a disjunctive.
Right, it's mistranslated as though it were a disjunctive.
So it should actually then be translated and or then.
Yes.
To indicate a continuous flow in the narrative, not a break.
Right. Translators have been bothered by the fact that Stephen takes a different position than what the Hebrew text does here. But Stephen in Acts is not what determines what Genesis means. And it doesn't create a problem for inerrancy, because no one guarantees that Stephen, is going to be 100% accurate.
Stephen is being quoted.
That's right. And so if Paul is able to quote from Greek philosophers, and it's an accurate quote, and that's all that, that's where the stake on inerrancy is.